Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA. Designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries, beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
New cosmic observations and a look at space fandom. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Space-based telescopes are changing the way we understand our universe. From galaxies light years away to mysterious comet-like objects, the James Webb Space Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope have been busy scoping out our skies. We'll speak with Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences' Seth Mayo about the latest scoop on scopes. Then, in a recent op-ed published on spacenews.com, historian Emily Carney explored the SpaceX fandom and how it relates to Elon Musk and his foray into politics. We'll speak with Carney about her recent piece and the political divide she witnessed in the space fan community. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? It's time for the Scoop on Scopes. From spiral galaxies to places where stars are born, JWST and Hubble have been observing our skies to learn more about distant worlds and even more about our own galaxy. And while they uncover the mysteries of our universe, these telescopes are witnessing it all unravel, peering back in time. Here to talk about some of these observations and more on galactic time travel is Seth Mayo. He's the curator of science and the planetarium director at the Lohmann Planetarium at Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences. Seth, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Glad to be here again. Thank you.
Both Hubble and JWST have some really, really interesting images that they've released recently. We're going to start with NGC 7456, which is a really great name. But what is it?
Oh, yes. Astronomers love their fun catalog names, keeping track of all the numerous things in the universe. So I'm glad you brought that up because Hubble is still such a workhorse of a observatory. It's been up in space for 35 years and still showing us amazing views of the universe. And we're kind of being reminded of that all the time, especially with this new image from Hubble of this galaxy, actually a very massive galaxy. And this is a galaxy, if you happen to come across the image of it, it's this beautiful spiral galaxy about 51 million light years away. And it's amazing how far these things are. So the light's taking 51 million years or so to travel from this galaxy to reach our eyes here, or at least reach to the telescope, but eventually to Earth. This is a galaxy in a southern constellation called Grus the Crane. What we're finding in this galaxy is a lot of this stellar birth, a lot of activity going on in the spiral arms. This is a large spiral galaxy, much like our galaxy. We live in the Milky Way galaxy, which is a barred spiral. And so we look at these arms of these galaxies, massive arms that contain millions to billions of stars, and we learn about how stars form, how they interact with one another. And what's also interesting about this new image from Hubble is that it's showing, or at least combining it with another observatory, the XMM Newton satellite, looking at the X-ray sources. There's a lot of ultra-luminous X-ray sources coming from this galaxy. So probably from a lot of active regions within the galaxy, again, maybe due to stellar birth or other kind of major events going on in the galaxy. And so you get this kind of glittering image from Hubble of the spiral galaxy. And it just kind of reminds us of this, the beauty of these large structures throughout the universe. And Hubble's still giving us these amazing shots today.
Yeah, I've got it pulled up on my screen now, and it is gorgeous. So you mentioned Hubble took an observation of this, and then another observatory looked at the X-rays, right? And that's because Hubble only looks in the visible light spectrum, so scientists have to kind of combine all these different observations?
That's right, yeah. And that's something that's always important to understand with telescopes, is that usually they are, you know, kind of specialized in a way. And so Hubble is meant for visible light astronomy with a little bit of ultraviolet, a little bit of infrared, but mainly in the visible wavelengths of light, much like our eyes see. And so it's geared towards that. And so that's what we're looking at here. But if you want to kind of draw a better picture of what you're seeing, you add in other observatories that specialize in a different wavelength of light. So X-rays could be one, or gamma rays, or radio telescopes. Different wavelengths tell you different things. So X-rays can tell you about very energetic places, sometimes around black holes, sometimes around collisions that are occurring, and sometimes just very active areas. You combine these telescopes with Hubble, Now you're just understanding this in a broader way, looking at all the wavelengths of light that are coming from this source. But Hubble primarily is helping us understand things in the visible spectrum of light that our eyes can see, just, of course, much better than our eyes.
You mentioned the X-rays, you know, that could be a sign of a lot of activity. So scientists are thinking by seeing all of this activity and looking at this through the X-ray spectrum, they can kind of catalog that there's a lot of starbirth happening, right? Is that what you're saying?
Potentially, yeah. Starbirth, or it could be also black hole activity as well. What's observed in this galaxy in particular is there's a very bright galactic central region. And like many galaxies, including ours, there's a supermassive black hole in the center. And it influences a lot of what's going on inside and around the galaxy. And so X-ray sources commonly come from these galactic centers. But if we're finding them pop up around a galaxy, and they're kind of unusually powerful in this particular galaxy, we're not totally sure why. What's causing all this activity is helping us understand not only this galaxy and many more that we've looked at with Hubble and other observatories, including our own. When we look at X-ray sources, we can say, what are the X-ray sources telling us about our own galaxy?
You mentioned this located over 51 million light years away, right?
Yep.
It's very similar to our galaxy because of its structure, and it's a spiral galaxy. Does looking at this, so this is what always blows my mind about astronomy, Seth, is that, you know, the light comes from 51 million light years away. So the image that we are looking at is what was happening 51 million years ago, right?
That's correct.
So are we able to kind of see what is happening with this spiral galaxy and then compare it to what is happening to ours? Are we able to use this kind of as a cosmic time machine?
That's right. And that's the thing about astronomy is it's always a time machine is what you're looking at, because you're always looking back in time. It takes time for light to travel these vast distances across the universe. And so when you look back, you can say, all right, what is that galaxy doing this long ago? And what does it inform us about our galaxy, what it's doing today, and what it will do in the future? And we can do this with other galaxies in different stages of their evolution. So if this galaxy is very active at this stage of its life, maybe look at another galaxy early in its evolution or early in its age and go, all right, is it more active or less so? And for galaxies that are older than ours and older than even this galaxy, we can look at, okay, how do they act and what are they like now that that light has finally reached us? And so we can build this timeline across the universe. And when it comes to galaxies, the timeline is huge. And so you need a lot of different examples of these galaxies across this timeline to put this story together. And that story then can inform us about our own galaxy and how long it's been around, how long we think it will be here for, and what it will look like in the future as well. And so this is hugely important in that kind of creating that timeline.
Man, astronomy is so cool.
For sure. Love it.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Seth Mayo, the curator of science and planetarium director at the Loman Planetarium at the Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences. We're talking about findings from our space-based telescopes. Started with the Hubble Space Telescope, but Seth, I'm going to move on to some observation, or an observation by the James Webb Space Telescope, a Pismis 24 star cluster, right? Tell me a bit about this one.
Oh, this is an amazing new image. And if you haven't had an opportunity to check it out online, it is absolutely gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It's incredible.
Exactly. And it's kind of like what Hubble sometimes drops occasionally too, these gorgeous images, especially the images that feature star clusters and nebula. That's where stars are formed inside these nebula. But this particular star cluster that was recently released is the star cluster, as you mentioned, Pismis 24. It's actually a very, very massive cluster in our southern sky. And what's kind of cool, I love this about astronomy, you can look at these deep sky objects in these pictures and then go outside and find where they are. And right now in the more southern sky, in Scorpius the Scorpion, still out in the southern sky, kind of now leaning towards the southeast, right above the tail and stinger, above Scorpius, is location of this, is about 5,500 light years away. So a little closer to us, still quite a distance, light still traveling 5,500 years to get to us from it. This cluster actually has these huge, massive stars, and they're young and they're very hot. It's actually some of the most massive stars we've ever observed, which is really cool. And for a time, one of the stars inside, called Pismis 24-1, was thought to be the most massive star we had ever observed. You can actually see it in the pictures. One really bright star with these huge diffraction spikes coming from the telescope itself. Anything that's really bright, you'll get a little diffraction from the interference of the telescope and the structure of it. And it makes it kind of more beautiful looking, actually.
Yeah.
And the brightest one is this, what we thought was a star that could have been 300 times the mass of our sun. More recent observations by Hubble and other observatories has resolved that possibly to two or more stars. So it kind of at least halved that mass, if not more so. So now you're talking about stars in the realm of 60 to 80 solar masses, which is still absolutely huge and some of the biggest stars ever seen. What makes this amazing is those jewels of stars that you see in this picture are interacting with the gas and dust that really most likely formed them. And this nebula that sits in the picture that you may see, it looks like a mountain. Think of it as a big mountain with a spire at the top. What's also cool is you get these kind of wispy clouds. It looks like clouds passing over a mountain. What that mountain actually is a cloud of gas and dust. Again, this is the big chunks of the nebula that you're seeing here. Remember, this is an infrared light. James Webb Space Telescope sees an infrared light longer wavelength than visible light like Hubble sees in. And so this is showing us these clouds of gas and dust that are being sculpted by the powerful stellar winds from this massive star cluster. So you're getting this sort of stream of charged particles, you're getting stream of ultraviolet light that's sculpting the gas, evaporating it. And what's happening is you're seeing these more denser knots, especially near the top of the spire. And these denser knots are resisting some of the flow, the outward kind of radiation from those stars, the stellar winds from those stars, creating these little dense little pockets. And what's really cool about those dense areas, we think are a star birth happening inside of them. Pillars of creation. It's sort of similar to what's happening.
Seth, the first thing I thought of when I saw this image before we sat down for this conversation was this looks to me like the Pillars of Creation, which is one of my favorite images. So I'm glad to know that I'm thinking like an astronomer.
It does have that feel to it. And just scale-wise too, from the top of the spire to the bottom of the picture is about 5.5 light years. So even just light itself is taking 5.5 years to travel that distance. And what I have seen and estimated at the top of that little top of that mountain, when you get a chance to see this picture, the very tippy top, the little speck is 200 of our solar systems wide. Okay.
Wow.
So if you stack 200 more solar systems wide,
that's
how wide that little speck at the top of that peak of this nebula is, just to understand scale here, right? Being affected by the beautiful star cluster Pismas 24.
Wow. Yeah, that's actually kind of terrifying now that you think about it. So thanks for that. Seth, before I let you go, I want to talk about one more astronomical observation that JWST recently analyzed, but also we've seen some headlines about it in the news. It's 3I Atlas. This is a comet. Tell us a bit about this.
Probably been hearing about this interstellar visitor called 3I Atlas. And it's actually only the third interstellar visitor like this we've ever discovered, because this is something that was discovered very recently, actually July of this past summer, by the Atlas Survey Telescope in Chile. It's a telescope meant to look for these type of things, asteroids and comets. When astronomers looked at this, they noticed the trajectory is on this sort of hyperbolic trajectory, meaning that it would come through the solar system, have enough energy to leave the sun's gravitational influence, and then go back out into space. And of course, what has been brought up about this is, what might this be? Is it an alien spaceship? Is it something that we, you know, can't explain? Well, right now, I think it's more and more evidence that it is a comet. It's lighting up like a comet. We see these features on 3I Atlas. We see a coma now. We see a tail, just like a comet we would find in our sky, right? That would be within our solar system. But this one is visiting from elsewhere. And what it's going to help us do, and what it already is doing, is telling us about other objects from beyond the solar system, what they're like, what they're made of, how they behave, right? And that will help us to better understand these other locations out there. We know they're there, but we got to actually observe them and actually study them so we know what they're like and what to expect from them, and maybe even notice similarities between them and comets within our own solar system.
Well, I'm glad to have you to break down the science for us. Seth Mayo is the curator of science and the planetarium director at the Lohmann Planetarium at Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences. Seth, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Brennan. I appreciate it. Love being here as well.
Still to come, exploring a divided fandom.
Whether people want to say it or not, a CEO at any organization, they define the tone of the company. So I found it really hard to be enthusiastic about SpaceX launches and Starship.
SpaceX, Elon Musk, and its fans. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Yeah. Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. As we move towards human missions to the moon and Mars, longer exploration missions beg the question, how can we grow food off our planet? From growing plants on the space station to mimicking off-world environments here on Earth, scientists are finding new ways to grow plants on the moon and Mars. Space agriculture. That's on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we are talking about Elon Musk, SpaceX, and space fandom. SpaceX founder Elon Musk has found his way into politics. In this current presidential administration, he headed the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, before a public separation from the Trump administration. Even before his foray into politics, Musk amassed a fandom in the space community, many of whom heralded his bold ambitions to put humans on Mars. But for a space historian and author, Emily Carney, she says she started to have trouble enjoying the company's success because of Musk's involvement in politics and his image as CEO. In a recent op-ed on spacenews.com titled, "The Grief of Fandom on Starship, Musk, and Losing the Spark," Carney explores the divide between space enthusiasts, those who are fans of SpaceX, and those who aren't, and the why behind it all. Here to talk more about her piece is Emily Carney. She's a space historian and the co-author of the book Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, From Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and Everything in Between. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be back.
Emily, your op-ed on spacenews.com is titled "The Grief of a Fandom on Starship, Musk, and Losing the Spark." Tell me a bit about what inspired you writing this piece.
It's funny, I wrote a similar piece a few months back, but it was way more strongly worded than the one that was released. And I wrote it and I let my husband read it. And he's like, my husband's probably my best editor. He read it and he's like, you can't put this out there. It's really too fiery. You know, it was right after the inauguration. You know, it was, you know, and some of the things I discuss in the article that was published were discussed in this one. So I shelved it for a few months, but it still lodged in the back of my mind because like when certain launches came up, like Starship, for example, you know, man, I should be excited about this, but I just can't, I don't want to watch it. Like I just literally, I'm like, I'll watch the highlights later. You know, it's in the article. I've put it out publicly. You know, the erratic behavior of Elon Musk over, I would say, the last few years has just really, you know, just turned me off personally. And a few people have misconstrued it as, you know, oh, you're going after the SpaceX workers. Not at all. I think there's amazing talent at SpaceX. And I wish the workers the most success. I don't wish any harm on any of their programs by any stretch. I want to see them succeed. Just the behavior of the CEO has been so public and so erratic that for me, it's been a turnoff. And whether people want to say it or not, a CEO at any organization, they define the tone of the company. So I found it really hard to be enthusiastic about SpaceX launches and Starship. The last Starship launch, I went on, I think, Facebook, and I put in a thing like, you know, is anybody having trouble getting excited over this? And I got a lot of responses like, yes, absolutely. I feel the same way. And I was like, why isn't anybody talking about this phenomenon? You know, and I talked to a few people and they're like, because we're afraid to say it. So I'm like, why not just write an article about it? Why not take the idea you had earlier in the year and just kind of distill it? And I came up with something that I was proud of to put out there. Did everybody receive it well? Of course not. I think I was the first person to put that out there.
In the op-ed, you write, a considerable part of the space fandom is experiencing a specific kind of grief when the thing you most enjoyed is now associated with other things that are irrevocably dark. We haven't yet found a civilized way to discuss it, so we're just distancing ourselves from the thing we enjoyed. I think that's really well said about what's going on. And I know, Emily, you've got your finger on the pulse of what is happening in the space fandom community as one of the creators of Space Hipsters, which is this 65,500 member group on Facebook. I've noticed that there has always been a specific fandom when it comes to SpaceX, right? I mean, the things that the company is doing really inspires a lot of people. What are you seeing in the Facebook groups and how people are replying as to how they're kind of evolving?
I see the people who are more like me, who are very ambivalent there is that part of me that's like, I do want SpaceX to succeed because I want us to be an off-planet civilization. And I think there are people who feel like that, but we're torn also because we're like Elon Musk. And then there's really not a lot of middle ground on this. Then you find the people who are SpaceX fanatics. They're allowed to get excited. I'm not trying to insult them or say they're wrong or anything like that. It's normal to get excited over spaceflight and rocket launches and things like that. That fandom also tends to either rug sweep some of the things he's done, publicly done, or they deny it. I talk about it in the article in January at the inauguration, for example. He made a certain salute or two certain salutes. And I state this in my article. And I've had people who are on the more diehard, you know, SpaceX fandom and they're huge fans of Musk who are like, oh, he didn't do that. That's not what he meant. But I saw it with my eyeballs. I think fandom is very complicated. I've been guilty of it. This is a less extreme example, but it's like favorite sports teams, you know, and sometimes they suck. Obviously, morally, this is a different, but it's like when your sports team does something completely stupid, you're like, oh, it was just a bad day for them. Come on. Find yourself making excuses, right? And I find how, you know, the more hardcore SpaceX fans, it's like that times a thousand.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Emily Carney about her recent op-ed in spacenews.com. Emily is a historian and also the author of Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, From Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and Everything in Between. We're talking a bit about the politicization of fandom of SpaceX here. And Emily, I'm wondering, is this just inevitable with how politically divisive we are getting as a society? I'm thinking too, you know, another fandom out there, the Apple users, and their CEO, Tim Cook, you know, being at the White House. Is this something that we're going to see in other avenues?
Unfortunately, I think so. You find a lot of things are being politicized that 10 years ago that were not being politicized. I think one example that we're seeing is public health. I won't get too far into the weeds with that, but you know, you see public health with vaccines. I wrote a longer version of this article, but because of space constraints on Space News, some of it got excised, and that's fine. It wasn't really too relevant. It went more into the weeds on, you know, the history of space policy. A couple of years ago, I was talking to an Apollo and space shuttle astronaut, and he was basically explaining how in the 70s, you know, there was a lot of concern that President Carter would axe the space shuttle if the Enterprise flights didn't go well, you know? So there was a lot of pressure on the gentleman who flew those flights to do them pretty well, because God forbid if there was like a crash or something. So really politics has always had a lot to do with space flight. Nowadays, it's just, like you said, it's very divisive. It's more black and white. You know, in the comments of the article I wrote, I've been trying not to read them because some of them are real ugly. I'm finding the comments are very black and white. I'm right and you're wrong. All I was saying in the article was, you know, Elon Musk chose to get political. Nobody told him to. That does have an effect on how fans of what he did perceive him. That has an effect on also his companies. I didn't talk to any SpaceX workers. It's probably had an effect on them as well. They can't communicate. I tried not to attack Musk. I'm definitely not attacking the people that work for him because he has a lot of great talent.
You know, maybe it's because of the timing of this or recency bias. But when I think back to the Apollo program and you think to the Apollo program, and that was a unifying event, right, that brought the country together for one common outcome. It was very geopolitical in nature, right, to beat the Soviets to the moon, but it brought everyone together. And I'm wondering if what is happening now with this SpaceX fandom, just a sign of the times, a symptom of the way that we speak with one another, you know, what has changed? Why doesn't everybody want to get together and cheer on SpaceX and Starship that is going to be, you know, our next Apollo mission to the moon?
I think it's unfortunately a sign of the times in a way. There are a lot of similarities between now in 1968, when Apollo really started to get off the ground. You know, in 1968, there was a ton of civil unrest. You had a lot of very high profile shootings and political assassinations. And unfortunately, we're starting to see that now, you know, which is really unfortunate. I'm not making light of that whatsoever. I want to make that very clear. There are a lot of parallels between then and now to some degree. I think the difference, though, with Apollo was NASA was very centralized. Apollo was a massive cooperative effort that was done by a government agency. I think it was very well publicized as well. NASA had a lot of money also at the time. They were going to start to make budget cuts, but at the time, they were fairly well funded to do these goals of getting to the moon. And when I've talked to a lot of the Apollo people, you know, the astronauts and the workers, they always use the word we. They don't say, I did this. They said, we did this. It's very all of them. Unfortunately, nowadays, there are a lot of divisions. I think nowadays, it's SpaceX has a huge monopoly on a space flight. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's what it is. They do, I would say, the majority of a lot of small sat launches. They do a lot of DoD type things. They really have cornered the market and a lot of launches, you know, and to the lesser extent, ULA, you know, does a lot of launches too, but SpaceX is doing tons of launches a year. So really, they've cornered the market on that. And it has become sort of a SpaceX versus NASA, because NASA, it is operated by the government. You know, in the last few months, its budget has been just killed. It has become more of a them versus us type of thing. There's a ton of differences between now and, unfortunately, the Apollo era. I do think that's why it was more unified during the Apollo era, because NASA was very centralized. They weren't competing against, I don't know, I'm just going to throw it out there. It would have been like if Lockheed had their own operation and was launching rockets and got maybe more efficient and started taking the lion's share of stuff. So there was it wasn't like that back then. Nowadays, there are a lot more vendors, you know, and SpaceX has kind of been a monopoly. So, you know, and they have gotten very efficient. So there is more of a division of, okay, it's kind of us versus them.
Let's try to end this conversation on a good note. And personal observation that I see as a member of the Facebook group, Space Hipsters, you're seeing it grow. It is a thriving community where all sorts of different people are sharing all sorts of different experiences, whether or not they are related to the space program, you know, by trade or by career or just casual fans. When you look at that, what do you credit the interest in space, and why are so many people coming to forums like this and collectively sharing their excitement for exploration?
We welcome all people who are into space exploration. I mean, and that's every program. We welcome the people who are into Starship. You know, just because I wrote that piece, it doesn't mean I'm saying, you know, people shouldn't like this or anything like that. I think people absolutely should get into spaceflight. If a Starship launch causes a child to become interested in spaceflight or a young person to get into spaceflight, I think that's awesome. That's wonderful. You know, I was more talking about my personal feelings and some other feelings. I wasn't making a judgment. I love that we have people from all different countries in the group, people who are aligned with all different space programs. It's not just, I love NASA, but we have people who have worked for the European Space Agency. We have people who are from a variety of different nations in the world. For me, it's just the people. We've all united over the same thing, and we all just love it. I think it's the people that really are the glue that bonds us together. We try to keep a very positive environment. We have guidelines in the group.
And as someone who has been doing this for almost a decade, I am never surprised by this, but I'm learning something new every single day when I scroll through Facebook and there is a Space Hipster post that comes up. It is a fascinating group with some really, really interesting people. We've been speaking with Emily Carney. She is a historian. Her recent op-ed is on spacenews.com, The Grief of a Fandom on Starship Musk and Losing the Spark. She's also the co-author of the book Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, from Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and everything in between. Emily, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at AreWeThereYet at cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.